From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very good afternoon to you from Johannesburg, from 101.9 High FM. I'm Kate Turkington, and you're traveling with Kate. And you may remember, if you were with me last week, I had just come back from the middle of the Karoo in winter. I was staying at Samara Karoo Reserve, huge reserve, third largest private reserve in South Africa. But I wanted you to meet the owner of that, because she's a Johannesburg lady, a Johannesburg girl, who used to drive through the Karoo from Johannesburg on the way to the coast for December holidays, which many of us did. And somebody told her there was a farm for sale in the Karoo. And her husband said, no way. And she said, no way. And you're going to listen to her now and hear her tell her story in her own words. And I must tell you, it is a recorded interview. While we were recording it, she's in the middle of the Karoo. First of all, her dog chases off a warthog, so we have to stop for that. And then a bit later, the same dog chases off a monkey that's coming to into the room. And in my long, long broadcasting career, I've never had an interview interrupted by a warthog or a monkey. So I'm talking now to Sarah Tompkins, who is the owner of Samara Karoo Reserve in the Eastern Cape.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
So Sarah, you know much more than me. You tell us the story of Samara.
Well, Kate, it's a long story. It started as a journey of discovery, loving the bush. I would, as a child, I'd go down to the Kruger area of South Africa. And then I met and married an Englishman and brought him out to South Africa, because I'd always had a deep-rooted desire to have a piece of nature somewhere. And we were sitting at the battlefield in KwaZulu-Natal when we met a chap called James McNaughton. And James McNaughton was from the Karoo, and he started to weave the most incredible tales of this, all the stories of yesteryear. So how the Springbok migrations would go through the Karoo, where you couldn't see for the dust for 3 weeks in Graaf-Reinet when the migrations went through that region. It was a story of the Cape Lion that existed in this part of the world that no longer exists today. Sadly, it's gone extinct. And after a couple of good glasses of Cabernet Sauvignon, we became enthralled with the idea of going to visit what was one farm for sale. When I mentioned this to various South African friends who said, because I grew up in Joburg, that we were going to look at a farm in the Karoo, they all told me I had absolute, total and complete rocks in my head, and why on earth would I do that? Because all they remembered of the Karoo was just miles and miles of absolutely flat, barren wasteland with a couple of bookies here and there. Anyway, we finally managed to drive up to the Karoo from, we had a house in Hermanus at the time. And I remember that our two little girls were 4 and 2, and my son wasn't even born at the time. And we drove up and headed into Graaf-Reinet. And I said, turned around and I said to my husband, if he thinks we're buying 1 square inch, he can think again. Because now I remember the Karoo that I used to drive through as a child on my way to, you know, annual family holidays at the ocean. Anyway, it was a typical azure blue day, the bougainvilleas against white walls in Graaf-Reinet, and James and Gillian McNaughton had packed the proverbial Karoo picnic. And as we drove out of Graaf-Reinet and off the beaten track, into these mountains, which, you know, there's an amphitheater of mountains, the Snoeberg mountain range. It's a center of endemism where 32 plants occur here and nowhere else in the world. And the biodiversity is quite extraordinary. So essentially what happened was that we fell head over heels, totally and completely in love with the landscape, and bought one farm.
And then how did the lodges appear? How did you begin to share it with other people?
Well, what happened was that we added to the one farm and bought another 10 to put together the 27,000 hectares that it is today. But what happened was the lodges didn't really come first. What came first was that my husband has a very strong scientific bent and approached the scientists at biologists and zoologists at Nelson Mandela University. And the head of the terrestrial ecology department was a chap called Professor Graham Curley. And he and Professor Boshoff were our guiding lights. And in fact, today, sadly, Andre is no longer with us, but Graham continues as our mentor. And what we did was that we did all the vegetation mapping and surveys and evaluated what the land could carry, what the historical species were, and worked out basically a sort of scientific plan of how we could move forward. The lodges came later because in 2006, which is when we first opened Karoo Lodge, it again was because we had no background at all in any way, shape or form of running a lodge or doing anything like this. So, and what we did was we decided that we had to do something for the community. And we're in a presidential poverty node in the Eastern Cape. It's really important that we provide jobs and we are upskilling people. So that's really how we got into tourism, was totally and completely, in a way, sort of by accident, by being led that and by the belief that we're in service to the planet and also in service to our local community, as we're one of the now largest employers in the region.
And which animals did you bring in first? I mean, there were animals and birds obviously already there.
Yes, we have we have over 66 different mammal species, over 225 different bird species now that have been recorded. But essentially what we had in those early days was just, were antelope species, and then obviously the predators that were there were caracal, jackal, leopard, yes, in the mountains, but we never saw them. But the species that I think that Samara has become really well known for is cheetah. And so what we decided to do was that as cheetah, there are only 7,100 cheetah left in the wild in Africa. They're a very threatened species. Mm. And so we got in touch with Anne van Dyck of De Wild. And we said to her, we would like to, we'd like to bring cheetah back to this region. And indeed, Sabella, which, you met Sabella, no doubt in 2007, because, we reintroduced her with two males in 2003, was the first cheetah back in this region in 130 years. Which caused a little bit of upset from the local farmers, but nonetheless, we managed to get permission.
Just a word on the great late Anne van Dyck. I was telling a grandson of mine, who's actually a game ranger, who's home on leave at the moment. I said, you know, Anne van Dyck, when she started the De Wild cheetah place in the Mahalisburg, I actually went to do a television interview with her. And, you know, she was almost a bit like the gorillas. She was almost laughed out of court because she wasn't a scientist. She had come from a totally non-scientific background, and all the scientists were saying she doesn't know what she's doing. And of course, she was the pioneer. And the story of Sabella that I want you to tell, in fact, paved the way for improving cheetah species in South Africa. Anne van Dyck was a wonderful, humble woman who decided to make cheetahs her life work and was finally accepted, given honorary doctorates by universities all over the world. And I just wanted to commend her there because she was very unsung in those early days. So now, Sibella was a cheetah. Tell us the story of Sibella and how she helped repopulate, if you like, South Africa with cheetahs.
Yes, so Sibella was a cheetah who lived wild in the northern province of South Africa. And fortunately for us, Anne van Dyck and de Wild had a program where they offered a reward for wild cheetah that were handed in order to protect them. And what happened was that Sibella was set upon by hunting dogs. And these hunting dogs lived on a farm with this farmer, and he set them on Sibella. And what happened was that she was mauled to within an inch of her life. She had literally cuts on the back of her legs that were so deep that she could barely walk. The hunters basically took her. They threw her in a cage. They left her totally and completely for dead. They put rope in her mouth. They put her in this cage. And then all of a sudden, the farmer's wife remembered that de Wild was handing in a reward for wild cheetah. And what happened was that de Wild got a call. And they said, basically, come and fetch this cheetah.
So Sarah is living in the middle of the crew there, in the middle of 27,000 acres. So she's already had to chase her dog away that was chasing a monkey and some warthogs. She's now come back to us. So Sibella got sent to de Wild in Mahalisburg.
So what happened was that the farmer's wife wanted a new kitchen. Remember, de Wild had offered a reward for wild cheetah handed in. And essentially what happened was that de Wild then sent a rescue team to go and get her. And they brought her back to the de Wild Center, where Dr. Peter Caldwell, who was a vet from Onderstepoort, came in and started to operate on Sibella. She was on that operating table for 4 to 5 hours, and he didn't even know if she would survive or not. But not only did she survive, and was rehabilitated after her horrendous wounds, were healed, but she was the first cheetah back in our region with two males, flown down by the battlers, organized by Anne van Dyck, and they arrived at Samara, and Sibella had first of all, 5, and then 6, and then 7, and then 2 cubs. So she had in total, most of them survived, bar one. And she basically helped repopulate 3% of South Africa's wild cheetah population. Her progeny went to, they went to national parks. They went to other private reserves. They went to provincial reserves. And finally now they've even left the borders of South Africa and gone to places like Zambia and Malawi. So and by the way, we never participated in the Indian cheetah relocation. We decided absolutely very firmly that we were not going to be part of that.
That's interesting because I was chatting about that earlier too, because several of those cheetahs, this is a debate for another day, but several of those cheetahs that have gone back to India have died already for whatever reason we know or don't know. But Sarah, I know, and you've been very, very, I don't know if conscientious is the right word about this, but I do know that many reserves, not only those in the Eastern Cape, have not taken their rewilding programs, let's say, as seriously as they might. They put lines in with cheetahs, lines of killed cheetahs. They want the tourism money. You're in 27,000 hectares. I know you've got 2 very small prides of lions, and as far as I know, you've got 5 cheetahs. So your rewilding has been incredibly careful, hasn't it?
It has. I think that what we were advised to do, first of all, Anne did say to me, she said, have you got any land on the property? And at that point, we didn't have any land on the property. I think what most of the scientists will tell you is that if cheetah are on the property before lion arrive, they've had a chance to display their own form of dominance and become very au fait with all of the boundaries, the parameters, the areas where they can seek refuge. I mean, for example, Sabella used to have her cubs up on a mountainside. We thought it was more like a leopard than a cheetah. And so we have had casualties, a casualty with a cheetah being killed by a lion, but really it was more of a case of the cheetah was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So we've tried to do everything slowly, methodically, guided by science. I think that's been the very core of our rewilding message.
And you have, I mean, you have white rhino, you have black rhino, you have lovely to see, when I was there last week, lovely to see the Cape zebra, say zebra because I have so many American friends, Cape zebra, looking quite woolly at the moment in their winter coats, the black wildebeest. So wonderful to see. And it's not in any means like a petting zoo. You drive for miles and you drive for hours and like, as all people who go to the bush know, you might be lucky. I'm talking to Sarah Tompkins, the owner of Samara Cruise Reserve, 27,000 hectares of pristine Karoo, the heartland. I think one of my colleagues in the UK actually called it the magical heartland of South Africa, the Karoo. I love the expression. But Sarah, along the way, you must have had, along nearly 26 years, you must have had some major challenges.
Yes, we have. I think one of the big challenges was that we were the pioneers in this region and that we were driving land use change that was contrary to what had been done over the past couple of centuries. So there was naturally resistance to that. It's also, there's a challenge too that arrived during COVID because, you know, tourism was put on its back feet, I mean, with its heels and basically the underbelly of tourism that was cut out from us. But I think what we did was we turned it to our advantage and we didn't lose a single member of staff. What we did as well was that we on part of the property, because we're 27,000 hectares, my son-in-law, future son-in-law is running cattle and sheep. So instead of being a pariah in the local community and being regarded as an eightlander who came in and, you know, with putting things like cheetah and lion and elephant back on the property, all of a sudden we are now embracing a different community. So not only the community, our township community where we do a great deal, but also our local farming community. And Dirk is very much a strong member of that. And in all of our conversations with San Parks, where we've looked at expansion of this footprint into a much bigger footprint in the region, food security and agriculture is something that is very important. And it's one of the, in the matrix of land uses, it's a vital component. So, and that all happened during COVID. So,
I know it, when you talk about community, I think it was so gratifying to see community working in your lodges, working in your camps, some of whom, your lovely lady, Annalie, who's the manager at Manor House. I mean, and let's face it, there are only now with Plains Camp, there's only 30 guests on that property or thereabouts at any one time. So you can be assured of privacy, of exclusivity, whatever. But it's so lovely to see the local community having taken Samara to their hearts and also becoming as passionate about the place as you and your husband Mark are.
Yes, absolutely. And Annelie is our community relations manager, in addition to being a lodge manager. And it's through her and with her, we have driven a whole lot of these initiatives in Graaff-Reinet. And Annelie is the one, she's created the Samara Heritage Day Cup, where over 700 school children participate every single year in a soccer and netball tournament. And Annelie is the one who basically during COVID, we fed the local community as well. And Annelie would literally, with a big pot in her kitchen, cook and worked with the local councillors and community in helping feed starving people of Graaff-Reinet, sure. Working yeah. with Ubuntu Pathways, working with the Sia Kolisi Foundation, handing out food parcels and cleaning gear. So it was actually, yeah, we've done a lot and we want to do even more locally. We support the Viani Safe Haven of Abused and Abandoned Children, Boundless, which is an assisted workplace. And as I said earlier, you know, we are in service to our local community and they form a very fundamental part of the very fabric of everything that we do here at Samara.
And just finally, I stayed, it's very new, it's only a few weeks old, your Plains camp, just four tents in the middle of a wilderness, obviously with staff there and whatever. And it's very much an eco camp because as a travel writer and as a traveler, I see that more and more visitors, be they local, be they international, are looking for that experiential experience. That's a bit Irish, but you know what I want. They want to be in the bush. Some want to be cocooned within walls of a beautiful manor house. Others want to be, as I was, bang there in the middle of it. So just tell us a wee bit about Plains Camp.
Plains Camp has a mess tent, a plastum pool, and then four tents. So it sleeps eight people. We have a minimum of two nights because we truly believe that you can only experience something not by rushing in and rushing out. It's a place where you can just be, you can relax, you can walk. We offer wonderful walking safaris in the morning and then a game drive in the afternoon. And it's in one of the most spectacular settings on the plains of Cam de Boer, which is where the Springbok migrations took place and where, you know, you see, as you probably did, vast herds still of Springbok and Eland and Gemsbok and all these different creatures. And it's just, I think there's a desperate need in the world today to just get away from all the, not only hustle and bustle, but technology. And technology, so there isn't much technology down there at all. There's simply campfires and storytelling and enjoying a wonderful chef cooking you meals over an open fire. And for the cold, when it is a little bit cold, we've got fireplaces in each tent. So it is quite unique and I think a very special setting.
And just to assure people that you can, there is somewhere where you can, your ranger will take off and charge your camera for us because you're getting spectacular photos. I woke up to a Bok Makiri calling. I woke up to a cheetah calling for his brother. Oh, Samara Karoo Reserve. And the website once again, Sarah?
It's www.samara.co.za.
Okay, Samara, S-A-M-A-R-A, www.samara.co.today. Thank you so much.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
Joining me now is Darryl Bristol Bovey. He's written a book called Finding Endurance, Shackleton, My Father, and a World Without End. It's had rave reviews. It's about the great Antarctic explorer Ernest Shackleton, who against the odds got marooned on an ice floe that was breaking up, breaking up. Can you imagine living on an ice floe that is breaking up with nothing but miles and miles of deep ocean beneath you? How he had to leave his men, trek across on foot Antarctica with two of his crew, and how they made it, how they actually made it, and he rescued his trapped crew on the ice floe, and not a soul was lost. It's one of the great adventure stories of all time. And of course, Endurance, the ship, was actually found last year, which makes the story even more relevant today than it was. So over now to Daryl Bristol Bovey.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very good afternoon to you. It's Travels with Kate, 101.9 High FM. And I'm sure unless you've been asleep under a bush or been in a 100-year coma or something, you'll have heard of the new book by a local author that's been gathering rave reviews. Long name, beautiful cover, Finding Endurance, Shackleton, My Father, and A World Without End, published by Jonathan Ball. Well, it's not only the extraordinary story of Sir Ernest Shackleton's 1914 expedition to Antarctica. I mean, that's one of the greatest survival stories of all time. It's also a very heady mix of adventure, memoir, and history. Anyway, joining us now, here he is with us, journalist Daryl Bristol Bovey. Welcome.
Now, thank you, Case. It's lovely to be here.
Great. Now, this is quite a long intro to a question, but bear with me.
Okay.
Sir Ernest Shackleton has been an iconic figure for generations, and he's now classic story of bravery in the face of almost impossible odds has been told over and over again, many times, and by many, many people, including survivors from his ship, the Endeavour. Now, the facts are known. Just in case people listening don't know the facts, on August the 1st, 1914, this was before World War One broke out, the Endurance set sail from London. She arrived on Antarctica, South Georgia, at the Hrytviken, I had a Swedish grandfather, whaling station in South Georgia. She arrived there on November the 5th at 1914. Okay, it was her last contact with the outside world for 18 months, and the last contact with land for 497 days. I mean, wow. My question is, Daryl, were you concerned that you were treading such well-worn paths by retelling the story again?
I was concerned. That was my first concern, but I was quite confident that there were new things to be said. Certainly, many of the accounts and the books, many books that have been written about it, haven't used all of the resources that have subsequently become available, including a number of the journals from sailors and scientists and people who were on the expedition. There's some journals that I used, that I read and used, that I haven't seen used elsewhere. So I was quite confident that there were new things to be said in terms of facts, and the experiences of the men. But I was very convinced, and this was the thing that really triggered the whole book in the first place, is that the story becomes a different story now after the discovery of the ship of Endurance. I mean, not only is there the story.
Yes, sorry,
to be told,
I said earlier the Endeavour. I was thinking of yet another expedition. Of course, she's the Endurance. Yeah.
Another great expedition. Yeah. Yeah, so not only is there the story to be told of the expedition to find Endurance, which was led by a South African captain, or commanded, I should say, by a South African captain, but there's also the fact that when Endurance was discovered last year, in March last year, there was an extraordinary response that was generated to it by all of us, by members of the public, you know, polar enthusiasts and just civilians alike. And there was something in that joy, in that feeling that after so many years of having things taken away from us, that something had been given back by the universe and by the world. And there was something in that made me really feel as though there was a slightly different story to be told, because the facts stay the same, but the meaning of the facts change.
How do you mean? Decode that for me.
So, for instance, when Endurance was, when the story of Endurance first happened, the meaning of it was really largely to people. This was 2 years after Titanic had sunk. It was the story of small puny men going into the world and rediscovering how powerful and overwhelming nature is. And, you know, the ice was sent from the bottom of the world to remind people that the world is bigger than us, and that, it can take away all of our power at any moment. It's the same lesson that people derive from the iceberg that sank the Titanic. But today it feels different. So today the ice in the Antarctic feels as though we need to protect, yeah. The narrative is that we need to protect it, that the ice is under threat from us, that we have become more powerful than the ice, and that the world, rather than, you know, forever enduring and being forever more powerful than us, is constantly, we now have convinced ourselves, is constantly on the point of ending. The end of the world is coming. And I thought, and I think, and I feel that the story of Endurance and the story of those men in the world tells us a different story in the light of this context, and tells us a story that we are not currently, right now, used to hearing, which is that human beings can endure, and that the world is neither all powerful, nor is it necessarily on the brink of ending. That there is a way of carrying on, and that, you know, that the highest moral courage, as Shackleton said, mm-hmm. is optimism, and the power that optimism gives us to carry on, to keep taking a step, to keep trudging into the white wilderness, and to keep going on.
Thank you. Now, before we get on to your very deeply personal aspect of your book, your talk, this has really got me, because I've been a Shackleton fan before you were ever born. But your descriptions of the suffering, the day-to-day life, the details of Shackleton's crew on their voyages and the things they suffered, their experiences, your descriptions, I found, made the book almost impossible to put down. And I'm sure you've been asked this 10 million times, how did you do it? How did you make us, the readers, feel that we were in those small boats, that our skin was peeling off, that our toes were dropping off, that, and yet we kept going, we kept singing. How did you do it?
Well, that was another one of the things that persuaded me that there was something new to be done and with the story, is that I've, like you, I've read those books. And they give you the facts and they give you the motions and the movement, but they never really answered the thing that always, certainly as a child, would occupy me, which is like, what would it be like? I mean, what was it literally like to wake up when you're living on the ice, when you're sleeping on 5 inches of ice over an almost bottomless sea? What did it feel like when you woke up? What did you put socks on? You know, what did you eat? When was your breakfast? And so yeah, that was the thing that I really wanted to answer for myself, as well as to just sort of convey. And of course, the thing that was a real surprise to me that the deeper I looked into is that it was unimaginable suffering. Obviously, it required unimaginable courage and fortitude and ability to persevere. But it was also an experience of great beauty in some times, and of joy and of comradeship. And most of, you know, through the journals of the sailors and the scientists, really the times of greatest complaints and unhappiness was before the hardship began. It was during the times of boredom, and when they were all sort of, you know, locked together in this wooden ship when they were frozen in. But once the truly horrific period begins of physical suffering, their spirits by and large rise, and they all get suffused with comradeship and camaraderie and a certain kind of joy, which I find very interesting, and I found very compelling, and which sort of chimes with, in a more extreme way, with all of our experience of life, that sometimes, you know, under the worst circumstances is when we feel most fully and ourselves.
And some of those lyrical descriptions came from not people with a poetic soul or people who'd even been raised in the literary tradition. Some of those experiences that you quote from the diaries, from the journals, are amazing. They're amazing. And obviously that's what that optimism, that suffering, it awoke something in people's souls. It's quite extraordinary, some of those descriptions. I mean, it would take a Keats or a Jeremy Hopkins, which of course you use to do justice. But some of these ordinary folk, these ordinary sailors, scientists, terrible generalization. You don't always expect scientists to be lyricists, but some of those quotations from the journals are so moving. Now, the research, did you have a grand plan? Did you have a sort of, I'm going to start at A, or was it just pick and choose?
My grand plan was to read everything that had been written. I didn't necessarily have the time to do all that. So the first thing I did was I reread every book that I had in my collection, which was all the big ones.
Yeah.
There were some sort of esoterica that I didn't quite cover. I didn't do the reading I might have done into the second half, the often forgotten second half of Shackleton's expedition, the men that were stranded on the other side of the world, waiting for him to walk across the Antarctic continent and come out there. An expedition which, you know, had its own bad luck and tragic endings. But I read quite furiously through all of the books that I had and acquired others. And I knew that would give me the central narrative spine of the book, the expedition itself, the setting out, the dashing of the hopes, and then the great journey home again. And so I knew that would create the spine, and I wanted to have it as detailed and as colorful as I could from a human perspective, from what it felt like to be there. And to be doing this, and to not have the knowledge that we have of the ending. You know, that's very often what we forget when we look at historical narratives, is how completely different it is when you don't know that your bold venture is actually going to work. So that was my spine, and then I wanted to write the narratives alongside of it, the personal narratives, the narratives of Knowledge Banger and the South African Agalas II that went to go and find them, and to weave it in as a kind of a counter melody, I suppose, that interweaves with the central line of it, and so I had that vague I had that vague plan from the beginning. I didn't know exactly what was going to be in those melodies, and so there were some discoveries there that I made. That was quite pleasing and scary for me.
Okay, now let's come to the book is called Finding Endurance. That was the physical, the ship, the journey. My father. Now this book is practically a hymn to your father. Why?
Yeah. Well, so the figure of Shackleton was very entwined, has always been very entwined with the figure of my father, who had a stroke when I was very young, when I was 8, and lived for another 2 years. And in that time, it was a sort of, obviously a curse, but it was also a gift to me, because in that time, I could spend those 2 years spending far more time with him than I otherwise would have been able to, because he was housebound and confined to his bed largely. And I'd spend a lot of time lying with him while he told me stories of his life and stories of the world. And one of the stories he told me was that he had been on the Endurance with Shackleton. Now, my father
did the timeline fit?
The timeline did not fit. Yeah, my father was this heroic figure, and all of the stories that he told me, were very compelling. But like any great storyteller, they weren't always strictly true. They were poetically true, I would like to say, and think. But even after I discovered that the timeline did not work, he would have been 5, when Endurance set sail. He knew all sorts of personal details about Shackleton, very intimate details that he had no way of knowing, and that only came out much later. In scholarly biographies, especially Roland Huntford's, that were only published after my father had died. And so one of the mysteries that I've always sort of pursued is how he knew so much, without knowing it. And I do think stories have the ability to generate knowledge that the storytellers have no way of knowing, that stories have a wisdom of their own. But they also seem to be some sort of a biographical thread or a kind of historical mystery that I sort of tried to find out and have come up with a vague solution involving his brother and Frank Wilde, who was Shackleton's right-hand man and who were a pair of disreputable chances and bandits roving the high felt of Johannesburg, and who may well have encountered each other in the years after
and
the Endurance. And so that's sort of
just to come in here. One of the details that stuck with you all these years, your dad said Shackleton had very small hands, and that was not known.
Very small.
That was not known.
No,
how did he know? How did he know?
Well, that's the thing. That was the great mystery that I pursued. And one of the possible solutions is this connection between his criminal brother, my father's criminal brother, Jerry, and Shackleton's right-hand man, Frank Wilde, who was one of the great connections to South Africa.
Yeah.
Between the Endurance, because he came to South Africa to farm, various things, and was given a personal loan by Jan Smuts to carry him through the years of drought and then flood on his farm. And then became a gold prospector and became sort of caught up in all sorts of schemes, get-rich-quick schemes, and finally died in South Africa, many years later. And his ashes were lost. And so they were discovered by a journalist called Andrew Butler, with the help of the man who also found the lost ashes of Enoch Sontonga, the man who wrote.
And your dad, how did he relate to Jerry? You write about him. As I say, he's like a Dickensian Mr. Micawber figure. He's a chimera in many ways. He's like good guy, bad guy. Charismatic, obviously a wonderful storyteller, but also a bit of a chancer.
Oh yes, yes. He was of that era. He never finished school and had to live by his wits. But he was a talented and intelligent man who had very high aspirations, I think, for himself. And And for a very long time, I thought of him as a disappointed man in his later life, as somebody who'd been defeated and felt of himself as a failure. And so because, you know, none of his schemes and talents really ever amounted to anything, in the world of success. And so part of why he and Shackleton are such important figures and so entwined for me, and part of the point of the book, I think, is a kind of investigation of what success means
in life. And endurance.
And endurance, yes. And success doesn't necessarily mean, I sort of come to the conclusion, a grand accomplishment like being the first to the South Pole or being the first to cross Antarctica. But in many ways, what unites Shackleton and my father is a more generous and perhaps deeper understanding of what success is, which is the ability to go on, to take care of the people around you, to bring them through, and to continue in the face of crushing disasters and defeats of life, and to go on and to go on and to go on until the very last one. Yeah.
And now, while I'm reading the book, I'm reading it and loving it and can't put it down, and suddenly it comes into my mind, his mum. Where's his mum? Where's his mother in all this? And almost as I turn the page, you have a chapter on your mother. Tell us about her.
Well, that was the unexpected discovery that I made in writing the book, is that my father has always been the dominant figure, the heroic figure, in my life and in my imagination, the one who took up all the space. Largely because he died young enough that, you know, he could never disillusion me, and I never had to separate, you know, fight to separate myself from him.
The scales never fell from your eyes.
Exactly. But as I was writing about him, as you say, my mother, who was always in the background, came closer and closer into focus. It seemed as though, you know, the light of my imagination finally found her and of my memory. And I realized actually that, you know, the truly heroic figure that runs through my life and is this woman who didn't tell me all of these powerful stories, and who wasn't the hero of any sort of self narration, but who was quietly a single mother caring for two small children on a government teacher's salary, and bringing us through the icy fields of our childhood and into the warmth of, you know, adulthood and of home. And so in a very real way, the book, was a voyage of discovery that brought me to her. And in a way that, I had never done before. And so I'm incredibly grateful to this book and to the process of writing this book for bringing...
preempted what I was going to ask you. Listening to you, you talk about personal discovery. What did you learn about yourself when you were writing this book?
Well, I learned that, and fortunately before it's too late, you know, what an important figure my mother is to me and in my life, and which I haven't acknowledged, both neither to her nor to myself. So it's done that. It's also, I mean, a really important aspect of writing this book was to sort of unite me with what I value in life and in writing and in working, which is the work itself and the process of, you know, of discovery, and the value to me, both as a writer and as a person, of, you know, the virtues of continuing and of doing the best thing that you can think of until you can think of something better, and then having the ease and flexibility to switch to that. It's a terrible thing to say, but I feel like writing this book has made me a better and happier person, you know, as a, and I think better to the people around me.
I don't think that's a terrible thing to say, and I think you're quite young to have so much self-awareness and self-knowledge. Now, a question really out of court to finish with. Shackleton, Ernest Shackleton, was one of the great heroes of his day, who has now, is still in people's thoughts and minds. He was brave. He was resourceful. He was above all a leader. He was stoked by optimism. I'm going to ask you those qualities. Do you see any of those in any prominent people today?
It's very hard.
That's a real sneaky question.
Slimmer.
Okay. Last question, just off the top of her head. Yes, no, maybe.
Yeah. I see no sign of those qualities in any elected official or anybody who's gone out of their way to seek fame, glory, and power. Regretting.
Oh, good. But we're optimistic, so we hope something will come up. Daryl, it's a brilliant book. I loved it. And I see a mate of mine, Mick Herron, gave you a great shout on the back of the book. Mick Herron, of course, a wonderful author of Slow Horses and the Slough House series. Okay, the book
He's
again.
Wonderful.
Finding Endurance, Shackleton, My Father, World Without End, Daryl Bristol-Bovey, published by Jonathan Ball. That's all for this week then. Been lovely having you with me. Join me next week. Look after yourselves. Lots of love, lots of life. And as I always add when I say look after yourselves, please look after others too.